At the end of the last century, ads were blunt instruments. They were either simple statements, such as, "We have shoes in various sizes," or outrageous claims in the tradition of P.T. Barnum. But as products and people clamored for attention, one keen observer of human nature observed that the best pitches were the ones people could not see coming. NPR's Brooke Gladstone examines the life and legacy of PR genius Edward L. Bernays in part two of a series on the psychology of getting and spending.
In 1917, Enrico Caruso was coming to America. It was a multi-city tour, and his sponsors were molto apprehensive. The great tenor was demanding and capricious and not likely to win the heart of the heartland, so Caruso's backers turned to America's consummate salesman, 25-year-old Edward L. Bernays. Bernays, fresh from 3 years promoting the Ballet Russe, paved Caruso's way with press releases extolling the man with the orchid-lined voice. He soothed and petted the transcendent tenor through Toledo, Pittsburgh, and Cincinnati, while regaling editors with tales that made Caruso an American hero before he sang a note. Bernays understood that shaping America's taste was not so hard once you had the key, and he knew the master locksmith. Bernays' mother was Sigmund Freud's sister. His father was brother to Freud's wife. Thus, young Edward was Freud's double nephew, and despite the doctor's occasional disdain for his relentlessly entrepreneurial relative, they'd take long walks together in Carlsbad.
He helped Bernays understand that you needed history, you needed sociology, and most importantly, you needed an understanding of psychology to know why people bought or voted or generally behaved the way they did, so that you could help reshape that behavior.
Larry Tye is author of The Father of Spin, a biography that chronicles the development of Bernays' signature approach, what he called the engineering of consent. That's what America's first PR men did for the Woodrow Wilson administration when they embarked on a vast propaganda campaign to sell an isolationist America on the war to end all wars, the biggest, costliest such effort up until then. Bernays was a junior member of that campaign, but he was ready 7 years later for another Washington hard sell, a president whose personality was so sour, said Alice Longworth Roosevelt, he looked as if he'd been weaned on a pickle.
I believe not only in advocating economy and public expenditure, but in its practical application.
Calvin Coolidge. Bernays used a cheap trick, glamour by association, to turn a cold fish into a hot dog. By putting a crowd of stars and starlets on a midnight train to Washington and then onto the White House where they whooped it up with Cal and the wife, the headlines blazed with such scoops as, "Actors eat cake with the Coolidges."
And will continue to be enforced.
As the New York Times said in a headline the next day, "President almost laughs." Did that transform his image? No. Was it important one little thing that helped him win re-election? Absolutely. Was it important in setting a stage for today's spinmeisters? Absolutely.
Bernays' most famous, or infamous, campaign to engineer consent involved the overthrow of a long-standing taboo, that against women smoking. In an interview shortly before his death in 1995, Edward L. Bernays recalled that campaign.
One day, Mr. George Hill, president of the American Tobacco Company, called me in and said, "We're losing half of our market." I said, "Have I your permission to see a psychoanalyst?"
If he couldn't go directly to his uncle Sigmund Freud, he went to Freud's disciple, Dr. A.A. Brill.
I went to Dr. Brill and asked him what cigarettes meant to women, and he answered very quickly, "Cigarettes are torches of freedom to women. They want to smoke to dramatize man's taboo." And then he added, as an afterthought, "and they titillate the erogenous zones of the lips." It occurred to me that any young debutante who was aware of the times would be delighted to walk in the Easter parade from 34th Street to 57th, lighting torches of freedom to protest man's inhumanity to women by a taboo against smoking.
This incredible march was so delectable that every newspaper in America had a picture on their front page the next day of these women, very elegantly dressed, with a cigarette dangling from their hand or from their mouth.
Within 3 days, women were smoking in Union Square in San Francisco, Union Square in Denver, and on the Boston Common in solidarity with their sisters in New York.
Then in 1920, women won their rights.
You've come a long way.
Bernays was always quick to point out that all this happened 3 decades before the Surgeon General's report on smoking. No one really understood the dangers, except, as Larry Tye points out, Eddie Bernays did.
One of his jobs for American Tobacco was to take any reports indicating the risks of smoking. If he could, he was to cover them up, and if he couldn't, he was to make fun of them. At home, he told his 2 young daughters that if they found their mother's cigarettes in the house, they should, as he said, break them in half, like brittle bones, and flush them down the toilet.
In his book Propaganda, Bernays observed that our minds are molded largely by men we have never heard of. This invisible government, he says, is a logical requirement of democracy, which needs a consensus for things to run smoothly. And Bernays enthusiastically set out to manipulate what he called this unseen mechanism of society. To sell books to a lukewarm public, he got celebrities to attest to the value of the printed word, then convinced architects to build bookshelves into their housing designs. To sell bacon to people inclined towards orange juice in a roll, he tapped doctors to pitch the health benefits of a heavy breakfast. And then, in 1954, to safeguard the business interests of his client, the United Fruit Company, he convinced the United States of America to make a revolution in Guatemala. Larry Tye.
Bernays took this government that was actually quite tepid in its socialism and helped shape them as a danger in the public eye.
Guatemala's new government was engaged in a modest reform program, including turning over tracts of uncultivated acreage to 100,000 poor families. Some of that land belonged to the United Fruit Company. Bernays responded by leading the media on carefully orchestrated tours of Guatemala, emphasizing the danger it posed to the United States, until an American covert action helped topple the Guatemalan government. The new rulers used terror to consolidate power, uprooting, torturing, and murdering hundreds of thousands of citizens. John Stauber is editor of the newsletter PR Watch.
He was dressing up an overthrow of an elected government and the installation of a brutal military regime. So we would think our government policies were doing the good thing, the pro-democracy thing, in a country like Guatemala.
Since then, PR professionals have often enlisted in foreign wars. Hill and Knowlton, for example, was hired by the Kuwaiti government during the Persian Gulf War, arranging for hair-raising tales of Iraqis dumping babies out of incubators to be told on the floor of the Capitol. Effective stories, but lies. Still, when the public does catch sight of the man behind the curtain, it reacts like Dorothy did, with rage and contempt. Successful public relations professionals know that when skepticism reigns, honesty and openness are powerful persuaders. That's how Johnson & Johnson reacted when packages of tainted Tylenol were found in 1982. It opened its doors to reporters who closely followed the investigation.
The net result of their openness was that Tylenol came back like gangbusters, as opposed to what everybody had feared at the beginning, which is that Tylenol as a brand would be dead.
Marilyn Lorry spent most of her career in the top ranks of corporate PR at AT&T.
The public relations people associated with the Tylenol incident are heroes in the profession.
But almost by definition, public relations is an invisible enterprise. And Bernays' pioneering strategies, using celebrities and scientists, linking products with causes and status, still work their magic, still engineer our consent. Brooke Gladstone, NPR News, New York.